If you prefer manual, time-consuming processes, then this message isn't for you. But if you want to slash per loan cost and boost productivity, then exploring Indicom's Genius Suite is your next step. Integrate Genius into your operations or pair Genius with Indicom's expert mortgage services for proven ROI. Learn how to get Genius at work by visiting Indicom.com.
Welcome back, Housing News listeners. This is Elsina Lloyd, and I'm the producer of this weekly podcast, which is a proud member of the Industry Syndicate. Today, you'll be listening to episode 10 of season 3, which features MBS Highway founder and CEO Barry Habib. In this episode, Habib continues his discussion on the coronavirus mortgage market meltdown. In the second half of this two-show episode, Habib explains why U.S. markets now face an uphill battle as the unemployment rate falls to great recession levels, and why first payment defaults on forbearance are problematic for the housing finance sector. Additionally, Habib discusses a conversation he had with Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Mark Calabria regarding the state of U.S. mortgage servicing. According to Habib, Calabria anticipates there's a good chance the nation's forbearance window might close at the end of May. But before we listen, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
A quick message from our sponsor, ArchMI. Lock in ArchMI's most competitive risk-based pricing for your loan with a 90-day promise. Your RateStar quote is automatically guaranteed for 90 days, protecting your pipeline and freeing you to focus on closing the loan. Limitations may apply. Learn more at archmi.com/90-day promise.
Thank you for listening, and here's episode 10 of the Housing News Podcast.
Hey, Housing News listeners, we're back for part two of a really special podcast series with Barry Habib. Barry, welcome back to Housing News.
And it's always good to be with you, my man. Thanks for all the great stuff you're doing for our industry.
Barry, we had our last conversation on April 7th, and we published the podcast on April 8th, and a few things, just a few, have changed since then. If I remember correctly, that was about week three of stay at home. We were still all making jokes about Corona being a beer, and it was pretty early. At that point, the unemployment claims had started to come in. We were at 10 million, and we had just, on the day before we recorded, had I think it was 6.6 million, our first big day of unemployment claims. But since then, many, many more. As of this morning, I think we are now at 33 million, filings or claims of unemployment, which is just wild. And I think that's in a really important stage to set, as that is one of the biggest drivers of what is happening in the housing economy right now. But to set the stage for all of our listeners, if you didn't listen to the first episode, we are telling the story of what is happening right now in this COVID-19 pandemic, in the form of a story. And we went through the characters, the setting, the plot, the conflict. A lot of details there. So if you didn't listen, I recommend you go back and listen to the first episode. But we're going to pick up and talk about some of the things that have changed and some of the recent conversations that Barry has had. Barry, I understand that you recently, this as of a couple days ago, had a conversation with FHFA Director Mark Calabria. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was really a great conversation. I was very pleasantly surprised by how open he was and how seemingly willing he is to listen. We made some progress on some issues, and I think that he explained a lot of the rationale for why he did the things that had to be done on his part. So ready to talk about that at any time. That was great. But I do want to mention one thing about the unemployment rate. So the unemployment rate, we're going to get that number tomorrow, and it'll probably understate the level of unemployment because that model's based upon the week of the 12th of April. So it's gotten a little bit worse since then. But we do an internal calculation here at MBS Highway, and a lot of others use our calculation. So we calculate it to be 18.7% right now. As we speak, we think the unemployment rate right now in the United States is 18.7%. That's based on a lot of rationale. You can't just add up the claims. You have to figure people going back to work, how many re-upped their claims that were off the unemployment ranks, but now they got this extension of 3 months. And then there were those that are no longer able to get benefits. You have to add that into the equation. So it's very complex, but we come up with 18.7 as the unemployment rate right now.
A few weeks back, a good friend of mine, Brent Beshore, tweeted that he projected 20% unemployment, and he got beat up pretty bad for that projection, and people saying that it wouldn't get anywhere close. So it is wild to see that coming, that aligning with the methodology and forecast that you have at MBS Highway.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonably good guess, because people will start coming back. I think the recovery is going to be a lot slower and lumpier than people expect it to be. So there'll be some challenges there. And the unemployment rate is an important one, because we know that there's such a big correlation between performance of loans and people having jobs, making their payments, and also purchase of homes, because you need a job in many cases to be interested in purchasing a home. So this is a very important thing. Now, this unemployment rate will come down, but I think people are expecting what would be known as a V-shaped recovery, kind of letter V, goes way down, way up right away. That might have been the case for the stock market's performance, but the stock market's not a good indicator of the economy. And you just think about this just logically. There was a great CBS poll that showed, you know, okay, if everything were open, would you go to a restaurant? Would you go to a theater? Would you fly on an airplane? Would you do these things? Such high percentages of people saying, no, I'm a little bit too nervous of it. So these are things that people have to reconcile. Now, we hope a lot of the data comes back, because many of us are extraordinarily frightened of this disease, and we should be. I mean, listen, we is not to be taken cavalier, but I do want to, I talk to Mike Rosen, who heads the Cleveland Clinic, every day. I talk to Tony Robbins every day. We've been gathering a lot of data on this, and here's what we have come up with. And it's factual that if you take nursing homes out of the equation and you take everybody over 70 out of the equation, you eliminate 80% of the deaths. 80%. Not to minimize those deaths at all, and not to minimize the other 20%, but the chances of this thing affecting you now, especially if you don't have any comorbidities, is very, very small on a mortality basis. Now, of course, we want to prevent it. We don't want to have it. We don't want to invite it. Goodness knows, of course. But I think that as that data starts to get out there, people might get a little more comfortable coming out ahead of having either a therapeutic or certainly a vaccine, although there's some really good news on vaccines coming out now. You know, Moderna is saying that they've got 600 people that they're going to go ahead and give this vaccine to, then set them off into the wild and expose them. So we'll see if it's past safety now, it's got to pass efficacy. And maybe by the end of this year, we could really start to see people getting shot up with inoculation. That's the thing that's going to bring us back to normal.
So you're based in one of the markets that's been hit the hardest, one of the geographies that's been hit the hardest. How are the people around you in your business community and other advisors like Dr. Roizen and Tony Robbins feeling about that New York City, Jersey concentration? Do you have more trepidation than I may feel here in Dallas, Texas?
Well, you know, here's the thing. It's definitely much more concentrated, because of the close proximity. People live in New York, and because many of them travel to New Jersey, you have, especially in northern New Jersey, heavier concentration. I'm in Monmouth County. You know, we're by the shore. It's horse country here, where I am in Colts Neck or in Homedale, where my office is. It's very quiet here. So you don't get as much of that here, although it is certainly a concern. My other residence is in Florida, in West Palm Beach, and you know, it's was much more feared in Florida, but it certainly has not had the outbreaks that were initially feared. Some of this is now calming down due to seasonality, of course, the preventative measures that we have. So there's reason to be optimistic, but I still think people are going to be afraid. And listen, here's the thing. So many businesses, they count on at least 80% occupancy or 90%, a hit of even 20 or 30%, which would be mild in this environment. Many businesses can't survive. And then even if you do have the demand, will you have the supply? Will people come into work? Will people put themselves at risk? Will people take mass transportation? Will people now be in a position to say, I'm going to give up my unemployment benefits, which I get for 9 months with an extra $600 on top of it? They may be making more at home. So you may have a business that you want to open, that you're allowed to open, that you now have people that want to come to, that you simply can't find workers to perform the job. So it's going to be challenging, in my opinion.
So let's keep the narrative going on the impact of COVID-19 on the housing market. So the week we recorded our initial episode, Mark Calabria came out and said that no non-bank is too big to fail. And you've had a recent conversation. So can you give us an update on how his thinking may have changed, or how his initial thinking may have been misinterpreted?
So he shared some data with me. He shared, you know, just live in real time. He said, Barry, nobody's got this data, but I'm going to give it to you because everything is delayed. I'm going to give it to you in real time. 6.4% of their loans are in forbearance. That's an important number to remember because it's above estimates initially, but not as bad as feared. And the uptake might go towards 10%, but he thinks he'll stay underneath it. Now, that's not the overall level because it's much more skewed towards HUD loans, FHA loans.
Yes.
Now, when we look at this and we say, okay, what's a very important element? When's forbearance going to end? Now, he can't guarantee this, and it's not his call, but certainly he's in the know quite a bit. And he thinks there is a very, his words, a very good chance that the window to new forbearances closes at the end of this month. I think that's huge. And all the leaders in the industry whom I've spoken with, pretty much every single one of them, because they've all called me afterwards to say, tell me what he said. And that, I think, is enormous because at least now you can put a fence around this thing and see where this problem goes. There were a few other things that he thought that he said that I thought were very meaningful. And that is if you deliver a loan to Fannie, one of the big, or Freddie, one of the big concerns here, Clayton, is that we have to worry about first payment default on forbearance. That's where you're getting all these overlays from. That's where all the panic is. That's where you're getting virtually a standstill on cash out refinances. This is all problematic for our industry. So when we are looking at this obstacle of first payment default on for a forbearance and that loan not being sold, he said, if you deliver the loan to Fannie or Freddie, it's delivered, that you will not be in a position to have to buy it back or have the ding of that 700, 500 basis points if it's already been sold, even if they do a first payment forbearance. Which means if you can get your loans in there quickly, and if the customer hasn't said in advance, I want forbearance, you're in the clear. So I thought that was huge. So now we've mitigated the issue to 4 months, but you do get $500 for those loans in forbearance. Or the real problem is the ones that just closed that you haven't delivered that have claimed forbearance ahead of that delivery, or they've gone into forbearance ahead of that delivery. And that's problematic. So I asked him of that, let's say it gets to 10%, what amount of those would be first payment defaults? And it's very small, probably a tenth of that. So 1% overall max, probably less than 1%. Okay, then you got rate and term refi, purchase, and cash out refi. Well, rate and term refi, 700 basis points, unless you're a first-time home buyer, it's 5. Same for purchase, but no market for a cash out refi. And this is so important right now to have a cash out refi. Why? Because home equity lines, due to the elevated rate of unemployment, have slowed and have become much more difficult to obtain. So a lot of banks slowing that down. So, okay, if I'm a person who wants equity, who wants to pay off my debts, really right now is when I need it. I can't get to that market unless I'm willing to pay these crazy overlays of 500 basis points. So it was important for me to talk to Dr. Calabria about opening up that segment by allowing a safe haven, allowing at least an outlet of where you could put that loan, because otherwise you're stuck with that thing. It's like in the movie Officer and a Gentleman. Maybe I'm dating myself, but if you remember that movie, if you saw Clayton, you know, when they break down Richard Gere and he say, why don't you quit? Why don't you quit? He goes, because I got nowhere else to go. Well, that's how lenders have to feel. It's like an Officer and a Gentleman loan. They've got nowhere else to go with this thing, which is why you're seeing these crazy overlays. So I had a really deep conversation. I'm going to try and summarize it very quickly here, but it was an hour conversation. So when we talked to each other, I said, so why didn't you do just a small overlay on everything? He says, Barry, can't do that. Because legally, he says, we thought about it, but a legal issue comes up. Because then we're taking in loans into forbearance. We're taking in loans that are in forbearance and not putting a pricing adjustment for it. I said, okay, that makes sense. Why 700 basis points? He says, that's what it would be the hit on a loan that's like that. Now I verified it. I spoke to several companies that have their own credit markets. They all came up with an average near 600 basis points, which is between the 500 and the 700 that he had. So they all agree. He's pricing it right. Now I asked, why not on cash out? He says, because it's riskier. I said, so what would the pricing be? He said, it'd be 10 points. I said, 10 points. He says, yes, that's what it'd be. He says, and I didn't do that because optics, because people would think, he said, I caught so much flack over 700. What do you think it's going to be 10 points instead of 7 points? People would have my head. So I'm like, I understand that, but when I asked him to break down the numbers with me, we said, okay, let's go. It says just what I was doing with you before. 10% total, less than 1% first payment. Then you got rate and term, you got purchase. Cash out's a fraction of 1%. I said, Mark, could you live with 7 points on those? And he says, well, wouldn't people give me grief over that? I said, no, people would look at you as a hero. because now you're taking on more. 700 is a good number because everybody's accepted the 700 and they know it's about right. You'd be a hero because you'd open up that market. If people knew that they had that availability to place that loan, then while you legally can't add a little layer of 20 basis points on all of them, the lender can. Now you don't need a 500 basis point overlay. You need 20 basis points on everything so that you can protect yourself for the one that at least you have a place at a price to send to. And he said, I'm open to it. And he said, I don't know if I want to leave it wide open. I said, what do you mean by leave it wide open? He said, well, maybe we restrict the credit because he said FICO is a very big predictor of forbearance. So he said, maybe we do it with a certain level elevated FICO. I said, well, 700, 720 people would be fine with that. And he said, maybe LTV. I said, I think 75 is still pretty strong because it's a low LTV, unless you think the housing market's going to crumble. And I talked to him as to why I thought the housing market was well supported. And he seemed to be very willing to listen. I got to tell you, he was very, very good. I was so pleasantly surprised. And he clearly is competent. He knows where we are. Now, maybe he doesn't know some of the intricacies and plumbing of our business or the details within the housing market of what would drive it. But he was certainly willing to learn and certainly willing to be open-minded. And he said he would run the numbers and take another look at that, which I was really encouraged. That would open up the whole cash out refi environment for us without these crazy overlays.
Barry, so much of the conversation in April was focused on the challenges that non-bank lenders and non-bank servicers were facing. And then we saw on this topic of HELOCs, home equity line of credits, we saw Chase tighten their standards to having at least 20% down, a 700 FICO, and then halting entirely, and then Wells Fargo following. What are the different considerations in kind of depository versus non-bank in the tightening of credit, and why Chase and Wells made this decision versus following a path of just raising the LTV?
So, you know, it's a good question, but when you have unknown out there, you tend to be more conservative, right? I mean, it's difficult to model things when you just don't know how bad it's going to be. And I guess no credit analyst wants to put their neck out on the line and say, well, I think it's going to be here and it comes in worse. And they're like, you're out of a job. So I think what they are trying to do is say, for now, till we get our arms around it, where does the unemployment rate top out?
Yep.
That's a big one. Because remember, when we started this, the reason why we started with jobs is because this whole chain of events is virus creates loss of jobs due to economic decrease, which creates problems making payments. So you have forbearance. You have people that now may not be able to purchase homes or make the payments on their homes, even if they're not in forbearance. You know, it's a domino effect. So if you go back to the domino of jobs, you know, let's find out where that is. Where are we on the containment of the virus? And then I can model. You can't put a stake in the ground right now and model with so many unknowns. Now, I don't think we're going to go much above 20% on the rate of unemployment. Some people do. Some people have had 30% unemployment rate. I don't see that because I see people coming back at a rate that is almost commensurate with those that are losing their jobs, which is why I'm saying, you know, if we got from 18.7% to around 20%, that's, you know, another big chunk of people, okay? You know, 3-4 million people that you'd have net of people that come back. So I do see around a 20% rate of unemployment, maybe 21 or 22 as a topping out. But once you have that, then I think things will open up once people see what's the rate that will start to improve from there.
You mentioned in your conversation with Director Calabria that he indicated that we might see the forbearance window close at the end of May. Is that correct?
Yes. He said there's a good chance, but it's not a guarantee.
So one of the things I've been thinking about is...
Well, but one second, Clayton, just to clarify, if you're in forbearance, you have the whole forbearance. It's just initiation of a new forbearance request.
Yes. I understand. So one of the things I've been thinking about is the Paycheck Protection Plan. And the measurement of PPP, if it hasn't changed, I know the guidance has changed a little bit, is an 8-week measurement for forgiveness after the loan is funded. And in that period, you're not to get forgiveness or not violate terms of the program, cannot reduce headcount, keep your employees on payroll. So many of the companies that accepted PPP cash will have their measurement period concluding in early June. So I'm concerned about a second wave of headcount reduction in the summer once that Paycheck Protection Plan cash is gone and the forgiveness period is over. that could create a challenging scenario if the forbearance window has closed.
That it would absolutely do that. And that's one of the reasons why we said, so you 100% are thinking along the right lines. So our model shows a little bit more of a delay. We show that into July because much of the PPP money, the early money, even though it was approved and used up by the time people started using it, that 8-week clock started a little bit later in April. So we think that that kind of goes, that was the beginning of it. So we think it kind of goes into a July timeframe. So we're in agreement with you. And that's why we're talking about a 22% unemployment rate as a peak on our estimates. So the wave of people that will need it may be met with lack of being able to go into forbearance. And that could create some potential issues with foreclosure. Now, I'm sure that they will be asked to be working with customers, or maybe there'll be a supplemental plan that's perhaps less rushed and more well thought out, because Director Calabria, what he admitted was, he said, look, and I have a quote, which was very, very interesting. I don't have it handy, but essentially it was, look, we knew when we rolled it out, we didn't have everything tied down, but we needed to rush to roll it out. And we felt like we dealt with the consequences later. And we're seeing those unintended consequences. So they knew all these problems were going to happen. So what you would hope, and I love the way you're thinking, because it's great. You're thinking way down the chessboard, that when you get to that level, that the next wave, if there is a next wave of trying to assist those duressed borrowers, is much more well thought out, that you have to prove hardship, that you can't just willy-nilly doing it, that maybe you limit the forbearance to a certain amount, that there's a facility to borrow against, or there's a limitation of how much they'll accept. So this has to be well thought out if there is indeed a second round, as you mentioned.
So maybe it's not the worst thing in the world if, like, the rushed components of the CARES Act and PPP and the rushed components of forbearance all kind of come to an expiration as we exit the spring and enter summer, and potentially see some longer term, more thoughtful, more qualified programs to assist people that may be hurt in that second wave. And let's not even forget about potential for a second wave of COVID-19
Yeah, Clay, you're 100% right. Now, I want to just say a couple of things on that second wave that we've contemplated when we went into our modeling. So I'll use my personal example. So Rock of Ages, okay? So Rock of Ages, we didn't take the PPP money because we knew exactly that was going to happen. We said, okay, so 8 weeks, what's going to happen? Nothing's going to happen. We know in 8 weeks from now, we're not going to open up. So I think businesses who weren't going to be able to open up probably passed on the PPP or looked at it in a different way. If you really intend that you will open up sometime in June, to some extent, as lumpy as it is, it will mitigate that second wave to a degree. So we will have some businesses that come back, some people will funnel their way into others, but there is going to be a component that definitely will see that PPP money run out, and now they're going to be in a position where they're going to be strapped to find a way to make the mortgage payment. Although the unemployment will help, plus the $600 a week will help, and that will again mitigate that too. But there is going to be certainly a component that is right in line with your thinking, brother.
I don't know if it's everything just working out, the pieces are falling in place, or if our decision makers were really playing chess. But it does seem like, despite the headaches and the concern and the drama, some of these things are actually working.
Thank you for listening, and here's a brief word from our sponsor.
During these challenging times, Quicken Loans Mortgage Services is committed to the health and well-being of its partners' clients, and its communities. Even though things are changing rapidly, you can count on the QLMS commitment to speed, certainty, and care. QLMS is now approving new partners within 24 hours. That means you can be up and running quickly and be able to help your clients. Visit qlmortgageservices.com to get started. Now, more than ever, QLMS is stronger together.
In our first episode, we talked about the characters. Another one of the characters was our Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin. On the 14th of April, he came out and said, we're going to make sure that this market functions properly. In the last month, have you seen any activity from the Treasury, from Mnuchin, that has been supportive of the economy? How has he played out in the last month? How have they been impactful or not impactful?
I don't think that we've seen direct action. He said that he's concerned. He wants to make sure he keeps the market functioning. But maybe because to some degree he's tied into the amount that he can do. Ultimately, there are things that Fannie and Freddie will have to decide, or the FHFA has to decide. Some of this is, let's see where things shake out before we take action too hastily. So you have all those components at play. But Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, I think right now is trying to figure out, you know, this additional $3 trillion in debt, bringing us to $25 trillion now as our debt, making sure the markets can absorb this in the sale of treasuries. It's one of the reasons why you've seen treasury yields move up. I mean, so funny you say move up to 70 basis points, right? Who would have thought that, right? Who would have thought we'd ever say that, right? Yeah. But the market now is trying to figure out, and there's going to be a 20-year treasury that's out there, which can be probably a hybrid between what institutionals will take, which typically take the 30-year version, mm-hmm. And then the individuals, which are more in the 10-year. So that'll probably be a hybrid. But I'm thinking that we have to make sure that the markets absorb this, because what we don't want is, we don't want to see a spike in interest rates here. So far, it's been great. It's been gentle. And the Fed's been having a very steady hand since we got in front of them. They've been keeping rates very, very safe and stable. It'll be interesting to see tomorrow when the BLS numbers come out to see what happens. By the way, another whole thing is the stock market, which is not a good indicator of the economy, has been on a tear. Difficult to reconcile and justify why, but it will be interesting to see if the stock market has gotten way ahead of itself and starts to decline. That could have a lot of fallout. That could be very problematic, because one of the reasons why we saw interest rates spike in early March was because the stock market's decline was so precipitous that it created a lot of margin calls in the stock market. And treasuries and mortgage bonds had to be liquidated to fill those margin calls. Remember, if you have a $100 stock and it went to 60, but you had $50 of margin on it, if I sell that, I'm not raising a lot of capital, and it's at a discount. So let me sell my good stuff. Let me sell my treasuries. Let me sell my mortgage bonds. And that caused mortgage bonds to drop, interest rates to spike. And then the Fed came in with the bazooka. Yep. And they said, okay, we're going to protect this market. So that's one of the things we just need to be careful of and watch for.
Yeah, we're sitting at, here we are on Thursday, we're sitting at right about 24,000 on the Dow.
24,000 or you know, almost, but the S&P is one that's very, you know, that's more telling, because that's, the Dow is of course a good barometer, but the S&P is the real one that you want to follow there. And when you take a look at 3393, I believe was the high, I'm going by memory. I think February 19th, we hit 3393 as the high, if my memory serves me right. We're just under 2,900 right now.
And we bottomed out at
2190.
We hit 2190. Okay. So you mentioned the bazooka, the Fed bazooka. How has that changed? Is the artillery still in the field, or are we still?
So they've been buying just a little hair under $6 billion a day, which is an enormous amount, because if you figure out, let's just say $6 billion a day, that's, you know, figuring on roughly 20 work days a month, you know, $120 billion a month. Yeah. At the height of the QEs, the height, they were buying $40 billion a month. And people say, oh my God, $40 billion a month. This, they've reduced it. They're buying a measly $6 billion a day. That's $120 billion a month. Now, how does that compare? Well, on the week of the 16th of March, they purchased $87 billion in that week. The week of the 23rd of March, they purchased $183 billion, and that's what caused all the margin calls. That's what we got in front of them, and that's what we convinced them to slow it down, and then they slowed their roll significantly, but they've held the market steady. I assume that the Fed will be in the game trying to take the training wheels off slowly, 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 like they have. They're testing right now. They're seeing, how much can we pull back and can the market stay up? How much can we pull back and the market stay up? Remember that the refinance market has been so strong that a lot of supply is coming to the market that needs to be sopped up. And that's why I'm saying watch the stock market. We used to be in a world for many, many years where stocks go up, bonds go down. Stocks go down, that money goes into the bond. That's what we've all been trained forever, right? Well, what we learned in March is that if the stock market takes a precipitous drop, that you throw the baby out with the bathwater and everything gets sold. And if you see that in the stock market from these very high levels. I mean, we're back to where we were like in November, okay? All pre-COVID numbers by November. If we see that kind of a real sudden drop in the stock market, liquidity will be demanded on assets like bonds, mortgage bonds, treasuries. And that's where you could see a spike in yield. That's where you could see a spike in mortgage rates. So we'll need the Fed at that point to stand at the ready and maybe come in but not come in too strong to create margin calls. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
I don't know if we learned this from QE coming out of the housing crisis, but what is the Fed's position on their hold period? Do they hold indefinitely? Do we see these bonds coming back to the market in 2021? Like, what would you anticipate there? Have we heard any guidance? I have not.
Remember the taper tantrum, right? So the Fed holding all these assets, and you know this is why, Clayton, you got to kind of get past the narratives that people try and put out there. Just go by the facts. And when people say, oh, the economy was booming, was this, was that, was it really? Was it really? Based on what? Based on the stock market, which is financially engineered. But the stock market was so financially engineered by all these buybacks, corporate earnings were declining. World trade was declining. Shipments were declining. As you recall, I was predicting a recession. I predicted it in late 2020. I predicted it way in advance, and we were headed there. But people say, oh, the economy's so strong. But it wasn't. If it was so strong, why were we running deficits in a boom?
Yep. I have pictures of you and your slides from Christine Beckwith's conference in Tampa, from Anthony Casa's conference in Vegas. I think it was Vegas or the Florida one, but you were calling it in the fall.
Yeah, because we looked at all those metrics and we're saying, look, if you're looking at what's going on in the economy, this is not a booming economy. This is an economy that is living on steroids. And if you pulled away that magic steroid stuff, the economy would have really faltered. And it was already faltered. Look, we were eking out 2% growth, eking out 2% growth with all the financial engineering. And we were running enormous deficits to get there. If we would have had austerity to get ourselves back, we would have been in a huge recession. So when people look at the economy before, was it moving along? Were we the cleanest shirt in the laundry? Sure we were. You know, we were in a much stronger position than many of our counterparts were, which gave us the benefit of that. And we're the world's reserve currency, which allows us to borrow credit very cheaply. But we were not running surpluses like you would in a normal boom economy. And that's what we should have been doing. Uh-huh. But nobody wants austerity. And I don't blame it because it's the public. You can't blame it on leadership because I don't want to get political. Okay? That's not what my intention is. Yep. Any leadership that we've had, you know, you can go back. All, you know, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. We've been running deficits and we've been increasing the debt. And maybe there's good reasons for that or not. But a booming economy should not be running deficits and increasing debt. A booming economy, just like if you're making all kinds of money because you're in a position where you're making tons of money, you shouldn't be spending more than you're making, right? Mm-hmm. If it's that good. Maybe if you're really struggling and you're just making ends meet, and now you need to put food on the table, so you need to go into debt. That's one thing. But if things are so great, you shouldn't be running deficits, but the general public doesn't have the appetite because who's going to be the one that says, okay, let's go in for some tough times here. Let's go in for austerity. Let's go in for really bad situation. None of us want that, right? So if somebody promises that, who's going to elect that person? It's the person that says, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. That's who you elect.
Back in my investment banking days, we used to joke that the folks who made a ton of money but somehow spent more were human leverage buyouts.
Yes, there
that
you
was
go.
The human LBO was a common term that we we pointed at people. But so moving on at the end of April, April 30th, Ben Lane at Housing Wire had an interview with Jay Bray of Mr. Cooper, and they shared some metrics and some guidance. So 200,000 customers in forbearance. That's 5.6% of the total portfolio. So Jay gave guidance that number was actually less than they projected, and they are preparing for up to 20% of customers in forbearance. So I mean, we're 10 or so days past that. I imagine that metric's changed a little bit. But what I thought was most notable about this interview is the CEO of Mr. Cooper, Jay Bray, shared that they're no longer worried about liquidity. And that is a very different message than so much of the rhetoric, reporting, analysis that came out in the month of April. How do you feel about that statement? Do you feel like that is the general feeling across non-bank servicers today? Or is this a unique messaging?
So here's another thing too. Get this. This is a very... very little known statistic, but it's really important that of those people who claim forbearance, nearly 30% of them made their payment. So you could be in forbearance and still be making payments. I think that has a lot to do with education because people realizing it's not free and that there is a payback and that there is credit circumstances that could occur. So that's interesting. So you have to take the forbearance number, and then when you do it on a cash flow basis, mitigate it by 30%. That's one. Two, so HUD's figured it out with the pass-through assistance plan. So that provided liquidity. Then Fannie and Freddie finally said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to give you max exposure of 4 months. Then this additional $500 per transaction for more liquidity. So mitigation. It is now in a position where companies like Mr. Cooper and others are seeing a little bit of daylight and feeling better about it, all in combination with the fact that they're getting their money back from the money that they were out on a liquidity basis from the margin calls based upon, I'm very proud to say, what we were able to assist with the Fed and stopping that craziness. That now is putting money back in the pockets when they really, really need it to help them with liquidity through this. And then the mitigation on the other things we talked about is putting us in a much better shape, because we had some really dark days there and we're not out of the woods, but we certainly have reason to be much more optimistic, especially if they close the window on this forbearance thing at the end of this month, that this industry will be safe and sound going forward. And we need that, Clayton, because the place we're going to when this virus is over, we get a vaccine, we all get shot up and we're hugging each other and high-fiving each other again, is an amazing place. You have to remember now, just to give you a quick idea, if interest rates go back to what the normal state would be, their normal state is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3%. At 3%, there's about 20 million individuals, 20 million that would be in a position to refinance in the money. And that's with a 720 FICO and 0.75% benefit. That amounts to $4.8 trillion. $4.8 trillion refinance business. In this crazy busy year, we're only going to do $1.3 trillion. I shouldn't say only, because it's a banner year for refis. Could be a record year for refis. You put that headline in today's Housing Wire, that it could be a record year for refinances. Yep. But I'm a big fan of what you do, Clayton. I read your stuff every day. If you're not reading Housing Wire and you're in this business, please start doing so, because it's very meaningful.
It's the projecting a 7-year high on refi. I mean, that's a cycle high. And we also saw today that purchase volume is up 6% week over week.
But from very, very, very anemic levels.
Yeah. So, but positive direction in a stay at home ordered market, and it proves that there still are transactions getting done.
Yes.
So coming back to Mr. Cooper, it does sound like through the release of margin calls, through the FHFA programs and the $500 credit and 4-month definition and some more definition around first payment forbearance, there some of the stress is lifting. Like they're we're not in the same the world is going to end tomorrow scenario that we felt 4 weeks ago.
Yeah. And there's a lot of reason to be optimistic with the progress from the medical front too. So, you know, we're starting to kind of buy some time here. We're starting to move through this and wade through this. And while it's difficult and while, you know, it's to some degree painful, the long range outlook is extraordinarily bright, and getting to that long range outlook is looking more and more and more optimistic. Doesn't mean we don't have, you know, we can't, there's still a minefield out there. You can't run around naked with a blindfold here through a minefield. That's just not smart. Yeah. So as long as companies are cautious and companies are looking at this from the perspective of, you know, let's not take on additional risk. Let's just get through this. Let's get through the next 9 months. The rewards are going to be immense for originators, for companies, and for customers. This is going to be an unbelievably positive outcome. We just have to get there. And I think that all of us in this industry, first of all, should be thankful, grateful, and feel very fortunate and blessed, because the problems that we look at of, oh, they eliminated this program, or, oh, I got a VOE day before closing, my deal died. That's a high class problem to have compared to an individual that does not know how they're going to put food on the table for their family right now. So
Barry, we're just scratching the surface of all the things that have changed since our first conversation, but in other topics, Fannie Mae announced they have 1 million mortgages in forbearance. That's 7% of their portfolio. Zillow comes out with some positive news and said home prices actually rose in March, and that they're predicting like a 1.18% home price drop in the next couple of quarters, like really small drop this year. So not big home price impact.
So let's talk about that for a minute. So remember, March, the beginning of March, home prices were accelerating. They actually went up in March on overall. So March, we didn't really start to get those stay-at-home orders and the big fears occur, right? So
it wasn't all pre-corona. We had a split month.
Correct. It's exactly right. It's about a split month and it was roaring. That was a strong market. Okay. Unlike the overall economy, the housing market on fire. Now, I'll tell you what our numbers are. Our numbers are in general about a 350 basis point haircut, starting from about a 2% improvement. So we look at real estate prices by and large in 2020, taking a hit of about 1 or 2%. Not bad, maybe 2.5%, but a lot of it depends on location. We break this down by zip code, but as a rule of thumb, take your median home price in your market, and of course, you know we put that out in every single zip code, and then go about double that. The market's going to be really strong underneath that ceiling. Once you get more than double the median home price, the market gets weaker and weaker and weaker into the luxury home market, and the luxury home market is going to be tough. But things will be amazing when we come back, because look, if there's a reason to say I want two things, I'm in an apartment, you know what I want? I'm cooped up in here. Man, I want space, number one, Please. Interior space, and I also want distance from others. Yeah. So people are going to want that. So we will see suburban sprawl increase. So you're going to see suburbs, and then you're going to see exurbs. Exurbs is that next level, and then you're going to see rural as well. All will improve, all of them. Housing formations, we look at people starting utilities, electric utilities, turning the lights on, right? So when you look at those utilities coming on, you're seeing household formations doing very well. Fastest growing segment, 20 to 30 years old. Fastest growing segment, up 2.5% in household formations. So you are going to see so much upward pressure on the housing market. It's going to be ridiculous, because remember, at the same time, all these people are going to want to buy homes. Builders have been building less because of COVID.
Yep.
So it is going to be a price pressured market that you'll probably see 2021 have 6% or so, maybe more, appreciation. So the little decline you're going to get now, if you can buy a home, it is going to be a great opportunity. Remember, every chaotic circumstance gives you opportunities. So you should take advantage of them.
Closed on a purchase last Thursday, moved in on Saturday, and closing on a sale today.
Wouldn't surprise me, brother, because you're usually ahead of the curve.
Barry, so let's talk a little bit more about home price. So you mentioned that once you get 2x median home price, you start to see kind of bigger declines. The coastal regions of the U.S., are we talking about median home price nationally or median home price?
No, median home price for the NSA. In your zip code.
In the zip, okay.
And remember now that 85%, 84.4%, let's call it 85% for round numbers, of all transactions in the United States are below 500,000.
So in that below, I mean, let's say median home price, most markets in the threes. So like a 1% drop from 300, we're still really only talking about $3,000 to $5,000 of like, I mean, that's, yeah.
Nothing.
I think a lot of markets can manage that. Okay. Barry, we're wrapping up on time here. We've covered a lot of what has changed. What are you watching right now? What are you watching in the coming weeks? What is most important for you to understand and see happen in the month of May?
So, you know, we have to watch everything because, again, that domino effect, right? So we're really watching closely what happens in the medical community, and I'm staying very much on top of that. So the medical community everything will be dictated by that. And then once the medical community provides at least a therapeutic or at least an ID system through testing, so you can have your ID there. I feel that we're going to be in a really, really tough situation to get any kind of traction in economic growth. And we need that economic growth because that will provide jobs, which will provide clarity and certainty that mortgages are going to get repaid and homes are going to be purchased. So when we take a look at it, we're watching first the medical side. And then we're also at the same time watching what happens to the rate of unemployment. How are we getting back to work and starting to see incomes back in the United States so that we can afford those home payments? So I think those are the first two things we're watching very, very carefully. And then as we progress beyond that, then we're going to look at home sales. But in the interim, for our industry's sake, cash out refinances are absolutely critical. And they are going to be, for those wise mortgage professionals who are watching this right now, that is where you really should be focused, because that's the most good you could do for people. That is the easiest way for you to increase your own personal production, as well as gaining tremendous amount of fulfillment. Because if you do it right, and that's the transition from being a salesperson to an advisor, from being a mortgage person to a debt manager. If you're an advisor, if you're a debt manager, you will change your customer's life. It doesn't really matter what the rate is at that point in time. And the universe we talked about is so huge that this is what you need to be focused on. So What I'm watching are those things. What an originator should be watching are what I just talked about, and how to increase their production and get through this time and really, really nail it and have their best year yet.
And Barry, so you're an advisor and a source of information for many loan originators or debt advisors. How would you advise originators that are so we're still early in May here, that still might not have access to all the products that they did 8 weeks ago? And they have clients who want that home equity line of credit, who want that interest rate with a two handle on it, because for some reason people think that's still available or is available. But like, how are you advising originators that that don't have exactly what their clients are looking for to keep prospects on the hook and advise their clients on the right debt solution?
It's a great question. So it's really mindset. You have to just control what you can control. There is enough business out there. There's $5 trillion of mortgages available right now for you to refinance. Why would you even focus on something you can't do? Or why would you complain about something that's out of your control? Just don't go there. Just say, okay, I got to deal with this right now. I don't like it. It sucks. But don't take that energy and focus it on that. Take all the energy you have and focus it on the $5 trillion of loans that you could do right now. Heck, if you aren't to the point where you're overwhelmed with volume, then you have to just rethink, what's the market I'm going after? What tools am I using? What strategy am I approaching this with? Because anybody in the mortgage business that is using the right approach, the right market that they're going after, and the right strategies and tools, their biggest problem is just not enough hours in the day for all the business that they're having. So I would focus on correct mindset first. Do what you can control. The other stuff that is a terrible inconvenience and gives you a lot of heartburn, and I know it sucks, believe me, I'm not somebody in an ivory tower. I did $2 billion in personal production in my career. So I've seen what you're seeing, and I respect what people are going through tremendously. But what I've also learned is that all the markets that I've gone through that created obstacles, and believe me, there were plenty, just don't focus on that. Focus on what you can do. So mindset is really your key to success.
Barry, thank you so much for your time. I love how dynamic our conversations are. You cover health and economics and the mortgage market and real estate prices. So many topics. I can't forget politics. So many things at play as we navigate what's going on in the housing world right now. Thank you for sharing your expertise, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Clayton, you're awesome. You are really a terrific, dynamic person in our industry. Thank you again for what you're doing. I can't wait for our next discussion, my friend.
Sounds good. Have a good one, Barry. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Housing News Podcast. Please don't forget to give us feedback and rate us on iTunes. Also, make sure to check out HousingWire's latest podcast, The Daily Download, which is a daily wrap of HousingWire's hottest stories, now available on Spotify, Google Podcast, and more. Until then, we'll see you next week.